This is Macro Voices with hedge fund manager Eric Townsend, the free weekly financial podcast targeting professional finance, high net worth individuals, family offices, and other sophisticated investors. Macro Voices is all about the brightest minds in the world of finance and macroeconomics telling it like it is, bullish or bearish, no holds barred. Now, here are your hosts, Eric Townsend and Patrick Serezna.
Macro Voices episode 173 was recorded on June 27th, 2019. I'm Eric Townsend. This episode of Macro Voices is brought to you by TopTradersOnPlug.com, the leading podcast when it comes to systematic trading and investing. Natural resources investing guru Marin Katusa is back as this week's feature interview guest. Now, of course, I'm going to ask Marin about gold, given the recent breakout. But Marin says his next big focus will be on the oil sector and buying the oil sector specifically. Now, to be clear, Marin doesn't think the bottom is in yet for oil. He still thinks lower prices are still to come. And he also thinks that they'll represent a fantastic buying opportunity when they do come. So he's already making plans, which he'll share with us, for how to scoop up energy companies on the cheap as the sector continues to suffer. And be sure to stay tuned for our post-game segment when Patrick and I will discuss option strategies for trading a melt-up in stocks if one should occur. And if you're like me and don't want to be exposed to downside risk by being outright long the market.
And I'm Patrick Serezna. Now, Eric, that S&P 500 struggled up along its previous highs near 2960, but this is not much of a sell-off just yet. I mean, we're trading around 2930 at the time of recording. What do you think is in store next for the S&P 500?
Well, you know, Goldman Sachs has a no-doubt warning, and I'll quote Goldman here, purely based on elevated equity valuations as measured by the S&P 500 Case-Shiller PE Index. And at current growth, the risk of an equity drawdown of more than 10% is the highest that it's ever been since the great financial crisis. So I'm not the only one who thinks that on a fundamental valuation basis, these prices are crazy and that the stock market is ignoring what the bond market is telling us, which is that we're probably headed toward a recession in 2020. I could list 100 other reasons to be bearish on fundamentals, starting with the bond market, but frankly, I don't think it's relevant because this bad is the new good doctrine seems to be what's driving the market. It's been the driving force since 2009. Now, certainly, U.S.-China trade deal and the Fed rate cut are very, very likely to actually happen in coming weeks. I think that we're going to get a U.S.-China trade deal. It might not be a great trade deal, but we'll have some kind of token agreement. The market will probably celebrate that and trade again up to new all-time highs. The Fed is probably going to cut interest rates, whether it definitely happens at the next meeting or it's not till the meeting after that, who knows. But they're going to cut interest rates at some point. The market is going to love that. Now, the fact that the reason the Fed is taking these actions is because they're concerned about bad news in the economy doesn't seem to be registering. The stock market just likes the idea of central bank policy accommodation. And I think that's a huge mistake for people to make in the long term in terms of how this is going to play out, because I think that that accommodation is going to be more directed at Main Street than at Wall Street this time around. Coming into an election year, it's going to be a very hotly contested public issue. One way or another, though, it seems like the market just loves anything resembling accommodation from the Fed. I think we're going to get more accommodation from the Fed. They just love the idea of a trade deal with China. I think we're probably going to get one. Now, from a technical analysis perspective, Patrick, and you know this better than I do, you're better qualified than I am as a technician. Once you've cleared 3,000 on the S&P, it's not like, oh boy, we might get to 3050. It's more like, wow, 3,500 plus comes into sight on a measured move basis. So there's plenty of reasons to think about how a self-reinforcing vicious cycle that drives a melt-up could occur from here. It starts with this bad news is the new good doctrine. Then you get continuing lower interest rates because the bond market's not stupid. They know a recession's coming. Those lower interest rates fuel more buybacks. And if the U.S. dollar continues to rally, as I suspect that it will, that supports Brent Johnson's melt-up thesis where foreigners have a much higher incentive to invest in the U.S. stock market because they also get the FX benefit. So I'm still very tempted to say, okay, I still think it's crazy here, folks. I don't think it makes sense. But you know what? Whether I think it makes sense or not, this new normal that we've had since the great financial crisis has been markets go up when the central bank accommodates. And the market thinks the Fed has its back. I think it's foolish thinking, but it's what's prevailing right now. So I'm really looking forward to our post-game segment, Patrick, because we're going to follow up on our discussion last week and talk about what option strategies you could use to play that upside melt-up if you think it might be headed toward a blow-off top where you don't want to be exposed to the downside when it reverses. So we'll come back to that in the post-game segment.
All right. Well, let's move on then to the U.S. dollar, because over the last week, we had a pretty solid drop right down toward the 96 handle on the downside of the dollar index. Stable for the last few days, but the selling was pretty hard. What's your short-term outlook on where the dollar could head next?
Well, first of all, in terms of the numbers that we're looking at and talking about in the show, I just want to explain that we've had a contract roll in the dollar index futures contract from the June contract to the September contract. And what that means is all these numbers are going to be about half of a big handle lower than they were before. So where we've been discussing that 98 level that the market's been struggling to get above, that's really 97.50 on the new chart. So all the numbers are half of a big point lower. As far as what's happened, though, Patrick, it's exactly what I predicted and exactly what should be expected. When you get the central bank talking about a rate cut and further accommodation, that's going to cause some people to think, well, that has to be bad for the dollar. And I disagree. I don't think it's necessarily bad for the dollar, but some people think it is. And so it's no surprise that you'd see a pullback. What I said is that would probably be a buying opportunity. We've had that. And in many ways, looking at the chart, it appears in the last three or four sessions that we may have already put in a bottom. Now, I should qualify that to say, by the same token, if I look at this chart, I could also see this turning into a very steeply downsloping new channel that's forming. And if that's the case, we just touched that bottom channel support line. We would expect to rally up to about 96.60, 96.70, and then it would roll over and we'd go to new lows below 95.50, which is where we just were in the last couple of days. We're at 95 spot 76 as we're speaking now on Thursday afternoon. Again, that's on the September contract. So I think the jury is still out. I'm leaning toward an upside resolution here, but when we actually get that Fed rate cut, there's going to be another knee-jerk down, probably a bigger knee-jerk down. I'd say that as I look, Patrick, at the chart, I really feel pretty good about my bullish thesis. The fact that we had a pullback here, it's the pullback that I expected that happened for the reasons I expected it to. It's a buying opportunity. Nothing wrong with buying opportunities. I like those. The thing that scares me a little bit is the size of the move that happened in gold. If I was wrong about the dollar, as I've said many times, I would also be wrong about gold. And boy, look at what happened with gold. Now, we'll come back to that because I don't think the jury is quite in there either. But if gold were to really take off from here and start ripping, you know, north of 1500 or something, I'd say, boy, I really have to rethink whether or not my basic theory about the dollar is correct or not. But for now, I'm sticking to my story. I'm bullish, and I look at what just happened as a buying opportunity.
All right, well, let's move on to crude oil. I know you and Marin Katusa are going to take a dive into this even greater detail, but in the last 2 weeks, we've properly retraced that big May mark drop in crude oil prices, and we're hovering just under the 60 handle on crude. What's next in for oil?
Well, it's been another big week. Let's cover inventory first. This was a really big one, Patrick. Crude oil drawing down 12.8 million barrels. And that's the biggest. I forget how long it's been that we've had that big of a drawdown, but that's a really, really big drawdown. Cushing, Oklahoma, drawing down 1.7 million barrels. It's not just the crudes, it's also the products drawing down. Gasoline drawing down a million barrels. Distillates drawing down 2.4 million barrels. The tape action in response to this, something I've always said, Patrick, and it's particularly important this week, you care more about the market's reaction to the inventory number than you care about the number itself. We just had an inventory report, Patrick, that it would be very difficult to imagine being more bullish than it was. 12.8 million barrel drawdown. Holy cow. And the gasoline and distillates drawing down in the same week. That's just the kind of thing that sends markets soaring higher. You know what happened? We got a pop-up for about 20 minutes or so, and it fully retraced. And we ended up closing the day below the 100-day moving average, which is about where it was when the data came out. What I draw as a conclusion from all this, it's certainly not that this wasn't a bullish inventory number. It was bullish, but I think the market was already pricing in as much bullishness as it could handle. And I think what we saw was the market got pushed from the 100-day moving average where it was. There's a big cluster. There's a 200-day moving average. There's a 55-day moving average. There's a, I think it's an 8-week moving average. There's a whole bunch of clustered resistance that was above the market yesterday. We went up and we tested that, but we didn't break through it. We stayed below $60. And as we came into today's close on Thursday, we pushed back below that 100-day moving average. So I conclude from all of this that the market has gone up as far as it's going to go up based on the current news flow. And I think that if the geopolitical risk with Iran and so forth were to blow over, and particularly if there was bad news on the China trade negotiations, I think this market could head south, and I mean hard. On the other hand, Patrick, there's plenty of reason to expect more geopolitical upsets to occur over the weekend. And, you know, it's a Friday tomorrow. A lot of people don't want to be caught short into the weekend. It's very likely that we'll see some short covering. So if there's another escalation, if there's a U.S. military conflict with Iran, that's going to just completely, anything is possible to the upside. But I think at this point, the market's gone as high as it's going to go until there's new news flow to drive it higher. With respect to Saudi Arabia, something I found very interesting, Mohammed bin Salman said on one of his TV interviews, Saudi Arabia does not want war in the region, but will respond if attacked. And my immediate reaction to that when I heard it was, yeah, right. Saudi Arabia hates Iran. It's their arch enemy. Saudi Arabia would love to see the U.S. go to war with Iran because Saudi's greatest enemy is Iran. What I'm hearing, though, from people who really have a lot of very high-level contacts is, no, actually, in this case, Saudi Arabia, yeah, that's true, they hate Iran. That hasn't changed. They don't want a regional war right now. There's just too many Saudi interests that are at risk, and they don't stand enough to gain from damaging Iran. They really and truly would prefer not to see any further escalation from here, is the word that I'm hearing from people who, as far as I can tell, really do know what they're talking about. So I think we really have to watch the news flow here. If there is an escalation with Iran, anything's possible to the upside. If there's not, and particularly if there's not, and there's also a breakdown in China trade talk negotiations, I think we could be back down to $50 before you know it. But, you know, we could go up to 70 if there's a big war escalation. Pretty much anything's possible. It's going to have to be watch the news and watch the tape.
Well, let's move on to gold, because you mentioned it earlier, and I really wanted to take a dive into this. This week, we started off with continuation to the upside. We printed north of 1440 on the upside temporarily. Now, in the last 2 days, we've been giving a little bit back on gold. What's your thinking? Is that far enough? Is that all we're going to see, or is this just the beginning of a new big breakout?
Well, Patrick, signs seem to suggest that a breakout past a 5-year critical resistance level in gold may be occurring. And I still stress the words may be. Now, at this point, it seems pretty clear most of the indications that we have are that this looks like it's real. It really is happening. The thing is, you really got to be careful, because so many people were just jumping for joy. I couldn't believe the reaction on Twitter. This move started on like a Tuesday evening at 8 p.m. or something. It's after market hours. There's no liquidity in the market. People were reacting, thinking, okay, this is it. We're guaranteed to go to 8,000 on gold from now. Look, that's crazy. This resistance has been in place for 5 years. Now, what could have happened is it could have retraced the very next day. That didn't. We held those levels, and they even moved higher from there. That's really good. We got a weekly close the day after we got that daily close above that critical level. That's good, too. More fuel for the bullish argument. But still, Patrick, this resistance level has been in place for 5 years, and we're seeing a breakout that's occurring on the back of some very, very sensitive geopolitical news with, you know, war with Iran and all this stuff. These are the kind of circumstances that can lead to false breakouts. Now, I'm not saying this is a false breakout. I would say that the preponderance of evidence probably favors that it's a real breakout, and it's a breakout that certainly has surprised me. But we don't have enough data yet. It hasn't been long enough to say conclusively, okay, that's it, the new bull market in gold is on. And, you know, we had Greg Weldon on the show last week, Patrick. He literally wrote the book on gold investing, and he told us last week he is super duper bullish on gold, and he's also very bearish on the dollar. He has a different view than I have on the dollar. Greg told me this morning that he sent a note out to all of his paying subscribers telling them to tighten up their stops on gold because he thinks it might tank from here. And he thinks that there's a very good possibility that this could turn into a false breakout that creates much lower, better buying opportunities. So he's telling his subscribers that they should tighten their stops up. I'm not going to list the exact number because out of respect to his paying subscribers, you know, they're paying for Greg's private information. I'll say it's a number just below 1,400 that he's telling them to set stops because he thinks that it might dump here. And that's, you know, a super duper gold guy. I mean, he knows what he's talking about. So I'm not saying that this is not real. What I am saying is the people who are assuming that we've got all the confirmation we could possibly need are jumping the gun a little bit. We need to watch here. So far, all signs are good, and it definitely makes me revisit the question of, okay, this has to mean one of two things. Either I'm wrong about the dollar, in which case I need to rethink my strategy there. And the other possibility is I'm right about the dollar, but we're going to move into that realm that I've expected for many years now. I didn't expect it quite yet, where the dollar and gold move up together. And I think that if I do put on a long gold trade, I'm probably going to do it with a dollar pairing at the same time, long gold, long dollar. If they move up together, that's great. If it turns out that it was a false breakout in gold, or if the dollar tanks, well, at least I'm hedged on the other side of the trade. So I do think that it's very important news, but I also think people are jumping the gun a little bit.
All right, let's move on to the 10-year Treasury yield because it just stays pinned to 2%. I mean, it looks like it's about to start bouncing off that level and then it comes right back down there. We've been more or less muddling here for a week. Are we going south of 2% here, or is this going to be a turn point?
Well, I think eventually we definitely will, but it feels to me like it's a pullback point. And in the interest of full disclosure, I'm not active in the 10-year contract right now, but I was long 2-year treasuries. I closed the other half of that position this week, taking profits there, not because I don't think it can still go higher in price, lower in yield, but because I think we're going to get a pullback and a chance to re-enter that trade at a more attractive price. So I've taken my chips off the table on that one. I still think that lower yields are going to be the name of the game, but boy, we're way overdue for a pullback, and it feels to me like maybe one is starting. That pause that you're describing in the 10-year, and as I look at the 2-year chart, you know, it's not decisively turning bearish, but it definitely looks like it's topping out. So I'm taking chips off the table, really hoping that we get a significant backing up of rates, a reduction of price, so that I can enter the trade on the long side of bonds at a more attractive entry. I do think it has farther to go, but we're way overdue. Let's hope for that big pullback that gives us a better buying opportunity.
All right, well, Eric, we normally do not comment on cryptocurrencies in the market wrap, but given the incredible volatility this week with Bitcoin moving up dramatically earlier in the week and then dropping $1,500 in a course of minutes on Wednesday, a lot of people are starting to wonder what's going on here with crypto. Do you have any comments on the subject?
Yeah, I have too many comments on the subject, about 45 minutes worth to say on this, and we don't have time for that in the program. So I'm producing a video. I actually recorded a video entirely on this subject last weekend. And it's, I think Facebook's Libra announcement is driving this. The video, remember, we're just in the process of learning to produce video at Macro Voices. So it's going a little bit slower than our audio production. I'm hoping that by Friday or the weekend at the absolute latest, we'll have that up on the feed and we'll certainly announce something on Twitter and so forth. You can just look at macrovoices.com for that video. But I'll give you the very quick executive summary right now. The cryptocurrencies like Bitcoin that are based on blockchain, everybody's all excited about them. And for our listeners who are part of the religion, I mean you no offense, but look, I really don't think they have a future. Blockchain is incredibly inefficient. There's a better way. And for years, I've been predicting we would eventually break what I call the proof of work barrier. Proof of work is the algorithm inside a blockchain that makes it go ridiculously slow and inefficient. There's a better way. It took a while to figure it out. People have been working on it for 10 years. We're finally seeing breakthroughs where a number of companies are breaking the proof of work barrier and introducing distributed ledgers. Distributed ledger is the underlying technology that makes digital currency possible. They're introducing distributed ledgers that don't rely on mining or miners or blockchains, and it works better. Think of it, you know, if you remember Microsoft Windows version 1, the first version of software usually sucks, and it's later versions that are pretty good. The first version of distributed ledger was called blockchain, and it sucks really badly. We're going to see something better coming really soon, and I think it's going to shake up the market. What I think is really driving this excitement, though, is Facebook's Libra announcement. Libra is a new digital currency being introduced by Facebook. And if there is any person on this planet who I think should not be in charge of designing how money works for the whole planet in the future, it's Mark Zuckerberg. As I'll describe in the video, I don't think Facebook's just introducing a currency for convenience. I think they have designs on eventually creating the currency system that becomes a global digital currency that replaces the US dollar, is the kingpin of the global financial system. I'm certainly not saying that Libra intends that in their first version or anything like that, but I think Facebook has designs on controlling how money works for the whole planet. And I think that's a very bad thing. I'll leave it there. And there's 45 minutes on this coming in a video in the next couple days.
All right. Well, thanks for the update, Eric. Now, this week's featured interview guest is natural resource investing expert Marin Katusa. Now, Eric, why did we invite Marin back to the show this week?
Well, Marin's been on a few times now. I think we've had him 3 times previously, and he's made some really fantastic calls. The first one, I try to always keep him honest about. It was an incredible call, seemingly, where he made a call for a company called Nevsun, and like 3 days later, after we had him on the show, it was up 50%. Marin will admit that it was luck on the timing. It was a good call. It was a well-researched call, but it happened that the acquisition offer that Marin correctly predicted just happened to come 2 days after he was on the show, made him look like a genius, when in reality, the timing was just luck. But then we had him on a couple more times, and the uranium call, the Sun Metals call, they've all really been fantastic. And so I've been following his newsletter myself, and I want to get an update. Now, what's interesting to me, because I'm very involved in the oil market, is Marin thinks the next big thing. He says, everybody's talking gold. Everybody's excited about gold. He said the time to get excited about gold was back when it was, you know, 11-something. The thing to get excited about now is not gold, it's oil, and it's not yet. Marin thinks lower prices are coming. I don't want to steal his thunder, so we'll let him fill in the blanks in the interview. But he thinks the thing to focus on is oil, so that's what we're going to talk about. And this episode of Macro Voices was made possible by TopTradersUnplugged.com. Now, although I'm a global macro investor myself, it has long been known to investors around the world that systematic or quant-based strategies are profoundly effective at extracting returns from the market. Top hedge funds like Bridgewater Associates and Renaissance Technologies discovered this decades ago. And there's one podcast that covers this area of finance better than any other. TopTradersUnplugged.com. And right now, Macro Voices listeners can even get a free book explaining how these systematic strategies work. Just go to TopTradersUnplugged.com/macro to claim your free copy. Again, that's TopTradersUnplugged.com/macro. Check them out. You'll be glad you did.
Well, thanks, Eric. So Eric's interview with Marin Katusa is coming up as Macro Voices continues right here at macrovoices.com.
And now with this week's special guest, here's hedge fund manager Eric Townsend.
Joining me now is Katusa Research founder Marin Katusa. Marin, the last several times we've had you on the program, you made some really bold calls, and you got lucky with one of them, which was Nevsun. I shouldn't say you completely got lucky. It was a good call, and it was good analysis, but you got lucky on the timing. It just broke out crazy about 2 or 3 days after you recommended it on this program. So I think the timing on that one was luck. The next one that you described on a subsequent interview, you couldn't tell us at the time the name of the company because it was only for your subscribers, but we can now tell them that was Uranium Royalty Corporation. You got your subscribers in on a financing on that one. How has that performed since we talked to you about it? I can't remember how many months ago.
It's done very well, actually. So Uranium Royalty Corp has done 2 rounds higher. So for all of our subscribers, myself included, which I was the largest investor in the deal, we're up over 50% at this date. So it's worked out well, specifically in a uranium market that's performed horrible, right? So 50% gain may not sound like a big win for a lot of speculators, but relatively speaking, it's a significant outlier and probably the top gainer in that sector of that market cap size. It's not like a penny stock, right? So it's done very well.
And how do you feel at this point about the uranium sector? Because as you say, the sector overall hasn't really done as well as we might have hoped, even though Uranium Royalty Corp has done very well.
Well, that was my whole thesis. So I'm probably the most hated guy in the uranium rah-rah fan club sector, yet I'm probably one of the largest financiers in the sector. I've always said that, look, this Section 232, which was started by a couple of friends of mine, and they openly stated that they got the concept from my book. Jeff Glenda said that on stage. So these are good guys that are fighting, and they've built producing assets in the U.S. So these are good guys, and they're doing the right thing for their shareholders. But I always said, look, I don't see a tariff system coming, and I publicly stated over a year ago that what would happen in this situation, I talked about this in 2015 when I gave the keynote at the World Nuclear Fuels Market in 2015, the elephant in the room is Kazatomprom. And what no one's really talking about is their cut-to-kill strategy. So what I said was, what I see happening, and I said this publicly at my conference in January, it's videotaped and recorded, I see a quota system coming somewhere between 5 and 7% of domestic demand starting. And then every year, you know, you could go 10, 15, 20, 25%, it probably caps out at, for multiple reasons. It's about permitting built. And I said, look, you don't need to go to strange areas that have political risk, lack of infrastructure that need $90 uranium, when you could just drive down in Texas or in Wyoming to permitted built. And my focus was stay on unobligated, so unhedged uranium production. And that strategy has served me very well. And I see it continuing. Like, there's no reason for uranium to go the spot price $75 in a month the way so many people expect, because people forget to understand that in Kazakhstan, which is 40% of the world's primary uranium production, even though uranium has been slaughtered, their currency has been slaughtered even more. So it comes down to, it's an FX play also. So there's multiple angles here to play it. So that's how I'm playing it, and it's worked out very well.
And I think the last time that we had you in the program, you again described a few deals. You didn't list the names out of courtesy to your subscribers, but we can now say it was Sun Metals was the long, and EQT, the natural gas company, was the short. How have those performed since we last had you in the program?
Yeah, so the Sun Metals worked out fantastic. So that's over a 200% gain for our subscribers, and they've made a true world-class discovery. So that's an interesting one, and it's in a politically stable jurisdiction. Now, there's still risks, obviously. Anything in the mining world has risks. So Sun Metals has been a real good player. That's now a Katusa free ride for our subscribers. And then the EQT, we published that in May. You're a subscriber. You saw the alert go out in the newsletter, and in less than 40 days, we were up 190%. So we closed that position fully and decided that, you know what, this happened faster than we expected. It's time to lock in those gains. And it worked out fantastic. So we've had a fantastic 12 months. It's been a great, great year for our portfolio.
Well, I've got to hand it to you, and I do want to ask you a couple questions about Universal mCloud, which is a new one, and I should mention, too, in the interest of full disclosure, that I am a subscriber to your newsletter and have sent my documents in on one of these financings, so I'll come back to that. But frankly, I want to first talk about an area where maybe you and I turned out to be wrong. We both thought that gold had further to go down before, and I think we both have felt ultimately there's a lot of good reasons to think gold goes up dramatically, but we thought it wasn't time yet. And maybe it's still not time yet, but boy, the tape is sure looking pretty strong. What do you make of this apparent breakout in gold? And what does that mean, considering that you and I both thought maybe that there was a little bit more downside before this happened?
Well, we've been in the industry long enough that we've seen every head fake in the last 10 years, right? So it feels, number one, emotionally, let's talk about that. It feels good knowing, you know, we've got 5 gold positions in our portfolio. Again, you know, because of my situation in the resource market, I'm a major financier of these gold companies. The 2 largest financings ever on the TSX Venture were actually from me and my subscribers. So we broke the record, and then we broke the record again. So number 1 and 2 are ours. What I see happening here is this is a fantastic price. Our picks, you know, we're up over 33, 34, 35% year to date on just our 5 gold stocks. And we don't need higher prices to do very well because the stocks we're in make money at under $1,000 gold. So what I was getting at was, look, there's a lot of reasons where I believe the US dollar has significant strength in the, you know, within the next 12, 18 months. And you look at what's going on globally, I think there's 3 main factors that are really pushing gold here in the near term. The China-US tensions, and I would include Hong Kong in that. Number 2, what's going on between Iran and the US right now. And, you know, you see these factors in Vancouver. There's a flea for cash. For example, in West Vancouver, it's a very high-end area of real estate, probably one of the highest priced real estate in all of Canada. You're seeing waterfront houses being sold for less than 50%. Now, that area is about 40% Persian, specifically from Iran over the last 25, 30 years. And because they have such capital restraints and inflation domestically, they can't get their money out. So they're hitting the bid on local real estate. We're seeing that factor. And you're also seeing them buy quite a bit of gold. And I think just the global political, what's going on is causing gold to attract some more attention. We just published a chart on my Twitter handle that showed the low on the interest for the S&P for the percentage in gold investments was about 0.07. Historically, the average is 0.23. Still insignificant when you compare it to biotech or the banking sector. So gold is a very niche market. And if we just right now we're at 0.1. So we've gone from 0.08 to 0.1, and that's caused a $200 move in gold. If we just go to 0.2, Eric, you're going to see a massive move in the gold price. But specifically speaking, the price in gold in Canadian dollars, so if you're a Canadian producer, is at all-time highs. If you look at Australian producers, all-time high. If you look at Russia, all-time high. And these are countries that are major gold producers. So this is a great price for gold. Could I see some pullback? I'm just naturally a contrarian, expect the worst. So I'm very conservative in my price models. I still use 1200, 1250 in my NAV model. So right now our picks are looking fantastic. And that's why we're seeing such big moves in them. So do I hope gold goes higher? Of course I do. You know, I've got a major percent of my net worth in these gold companies, but it sure feels good. But don't be surprised if you see a pullback here also.
Okay, I want to move on to the main topic today, which is going to be crude oil. But before we get into strategies for how to buy low oil prices, I think we need to first discuss what's going on in the market, because we had fairly low oil prices, and I thought there was a lot of indication a couple weeks ago that they were still headed lower. As I looked at the series of inventory reports, the other supply and demand data, the signs that we're seeing of an oncoming recession in 2020, looked to me like we were headed much lower still in prices. Then we had the whole tanker attack thing. At first, people said Iran did it. Iran said they didn't do it. Some people believed Iran didn't do it. And then as soon as that happened, Iran did something else that they didn't try to hide and shot down a U.S. drone, proudly proclaiming that they had done so. So needless to say, that has created just a straight up spike in energy prices. I observe two things. One is, given that we're talking about real honest to God war threats here, the price hasn't gone up that much. And it tells me that the fundamentals really are pointing toward lower prices if and when the geopolitics blow over. And I guess the other thing that I've seen is I think that probably, even if we have these geopolitics, I don't see it, the geopolitical situation, playing out to really affect energy that much. I mean, yeah, Iran is getting in big trouble with the United States. Iranian oil was already discounted out of production, really. I mean, it's in the gray market, but it's not really affecting things. So what do you make of the current situation with oil prices before we get into the details of what the strategy would be for buying the bottom when that comes?
So a couple of things we should look at from the canary in the coal mine, things that I look at from a, you know, mass psychology standpoint is it's been over 100 years when Shell first increased the size of their tankers and the safety to go through the straits like Hormuz back then as an Aden. And you look at what's going on and, you know, the biggest winner of all this isn't the oil speculators. It's actually the insurance companies because the price to insure a tanker is up over 1,000%. So it's 10 times more than it was just 60 days ago. And you look at, okay, let's think about if you look, go back to over 100 years, if everyone thought that if something happened in the Strait of Hormuz, would Iran ever bomb an oil tanker or a boat or even threaten to do so? Historically speaking, Eric, I think everyone would agree if you go back 10, 15, 20 years that the price of oil should shoot up $10, $20, $30 or, you know, have a big significant move. The day it happened, it moved up $1. You know, and I got to say, I sat back and went, wow. You know, that was a true signal that there's just a lot of contentment in the market. Then you pull back to say, okay, let's focus on the U.S. guys. And you look at what's happening there with the infrastructure. You know, by the end of this year, you're going to have a major infrastructure project with the pipeline capacity finished in the Permian. That's going to unlock about 800,000 barrels. So the velocity of oil movement is going to increase. Then, because I'm Canadian and naturally we you know, you're always focused on things that are happening in your own country, the backwardation of the infrastructure, the resource sector in Canada under the current administration really is shocking, where we're the third largest endowment of oil in the world, and we've actually been decreasing production. Why? Because we're relying on getting it out of rail, which is much riskier than the pipelines, and we just can't get these pipelines built. Even if they're permitted and they go through 10 years and spend $1 billion to get there, the local courts move it around. So, you know, it's churned no bid in Canada, but yet there's a lot of oil waiting to get out. So I think the oil markets have figured out that there's no shortage of oil. So this peak oil thesis, which for 15 years I've been writing about, is false because technology will change it. You're seeing, and I think you and I are in the same boat in the near term, I see significant downward pressure in the near term on the price of oil. Now, then you got to look at what's OPEC doing, and then you look at Iran rattling the sabers with what their comment last night with their retaliation to Trump's new sanctions. So there's a lot of reasons to be bullish politically, the political risk in the oil markets, but I think the market has come to the realization that the supply side will be there. It's just a price of getting it to the market, whether via rail or more tankers, and then paying for, you know, 1,000% more insurance to insure it through the strait. So that's kind of where I'm at with the sector right now. And then you look at the producers and you look at their debt balance sheet and how can they handle, okay, at $60 oil, everybody extends and pretends their debt. At 50, how do they do? What about at 40? Or 35. So these are the stress tests that you have to do to the financial analysis of these producers, because the whole, you know, drill baby drill, well, the reality is even though the Fed may cut the rates, I've been publishing a lot of data showing, well, the real market, and because they've gone through this and they've seen that these companies aren't exactly the most disciplined or returner of capital, the real rate of lending to the companies is significantly higher, and it's actually no longer linked to the Fed rate. So this is where a lot of people disagree with me, but you look at what's going on in the bond market or even in the, you know, the junk bonds in the oil patch. And the reality is most of the debt in the intermediates and the mid tiers and juniors is junk debt. So I see high single digits to the low teens. And the reality is that $40, very few of these guys, you know, if you use $35, $40, very few of these guys survive.
Marin, do you have a downside target number where you're saying, okay, I'm waiting for oil to get to price X and that's where we start really buying? Or are you looking at this more as something where you just scale in over time and figure that you're going to accept the averages?
So I've been doing this long enough that I've never quite been able to pick a bottom and I've never sold on the top. So I'm a big believer in scaling in and scaling out, Eric. So, you know, in my newsletter, as you see, I do this tranche buying system. I have this matrix, you know, buy your first tranche at 25% and then you kind of ease in. And as you start getting in, you start getting comfortable with the position, then you can get in through a financing. That's something I do a lot of in my newsletter is because of the size I buy in, it's hard for me to get a position in the open market for a lot of these mid-tiers or juniors. So I structure a lot of these private placements. And then because of the size of my list and my following, I say, hey, you're a subscriber. You can get in at the same price and same terms. If you like it, if not, no big deal. And then the subscribers get out 2 days in advance. So where I'm at personally right now is I believe that we'll see more downward pressure in the price of oil. And I believe right now is not the time to jump in full throttle. I think it's time, you know, I've got my two or three favorite Canadian producers. I've got my two favorite US producers and my international guys. That's what I'm going to be publishing about. And I've got a real big, interesting angle that for my subscribers that I'm publishing next week on a really interesting angle that nobody has published in the institutional world yet about. But I think in 2 or 3 years, it'll be the hottest play in the oil patch. And people forget about for every barrel of oil that gets moved, what other liquid is required and what do you do with that? And there's a big value add to this whole oil game in North America. So it's an interesting angle on it. And I think patience, you know, and it's funny, Eric, everybody wants to be a contrarian, but very few people actually have the testicular fortitude to be a contrarian. Right now, when I publish something on gold, it literally gets 10 times the reaction in the market than something if I publish on, say, uranium or oil or whatever. That tells me that the market's hot for gold. But 3-4 months ago, when I would publish on gold, nobody cared, right? It was this interesting dilemma of what we see going on in the market. So right now with oil, I think it's time to roll up your sleeves and do your deep dive analysis and stress tests. And I also believe there's no reason to take any risks in this market. Things are getting so cheap in the oil patch that, you know, I can get a senior producer valued at, you know, 15 to 25 year lows on financial metrics. Why bother with a development story or something that is in a risky jurisdiction? You just don't need to do that. That's the beauty of being a true contrarian. Just like in gold, look at the move we've had, but for, you know, you mentioned Nevsun that it was a lucky pick, or on your show, it sounded lucky, but I was there 5 years, 6 years at the site. I financed the company for years. I published 1 year before I came on your show. So yes, it looked like, oh, wow, this guy just talked about it and a week or two later, then it got bought out 5 months later. But I was there for 2 years before it happened in a big way as one of the largest investors in the deal. So to be a contrarian is a lonely trade. And that's what makes me excited about oil, because people are starting to really hate it. And that's when I like getting into things.
Let's talk a little bit more about why you like it, why some people hate it, and so forth, because I think we have some very similar ideas, but in many ways, they may be a little different. You have, for as long as I've known you, been a peak oil disbeliever, and I've looked at it a little bit differently. I think of it as it's peak cheap oil. You know, we're not going to run out of oil. What's going to happen is the amount of technological complexity that's required to extract it from the ground is going to keep getting more, and therefore the cost of extraction is going to keep getting higher. And over time, the cost of energy as a percentage of GDP is going to get higher. Now, we've just for the last 10 years been on this amazing amazing, amazing ride thanks to, I think, central bank largesse making so much money available to the shale patch that all of a sudden we've got overproduction of U.S. shale oil. What I'm starting to see is the rig count has been declining even when prices were reasonably economic. And we're starting to see a plateauing maybe of that U.S. production growth. I'm not sure it's over yet, but maybe it's slowing down. The way that I look at this, Maren, is I don't think the world ever comes to an end. We always find a new technology that's going to, you know, produce more oil if we run out of the last one. But when we run out of the ability to produce oil using the fracturing and horizontal drilling technologies that have made shale oil possible, when that technology is not enough anymore, then we're really moving to higher prices because the next choices are deep water offshore and Arctic offshore and, you know, all these things that are, they're all possible, but they cost a lot of money. So the real question in my mind is, you know, how much longer does shale have left in it before these shale plays are played out and the industry has to start looking to other sources? And it seems to me like you want to be ahead of that. Before we get to that point, you want to have done all your buying. So how close are we?
So great point. And your comment kind of reminded me of the big debate my good friend Rick Rule and I had at a big conference in New Orleans in the fall of, or was it October, November of 2014. It's on YouTube. And, you know, his thesis was exactly what you're saying. It's expensive, you know, it's cheap money and it'll never go under 75. And I said, oil was about $90 at the time. And I said, not only will oil go under 40, we will see certain producers be able to make money at $30 oil. Let me explain. You talked about the decrease in drill rigs. That number is absolutely irrelevant. People use, for example, and I use the example of, you know, historically speaking, guys used in the industry, they used to use the dollar value of gas used to have a 6-to-1 ratio with oil, especially when they do buoys or BOEs, barrel of oil equivalent, because it is on an energy equivalent basis, 6-to-1, just under 6-to-1. So they said, well, it should be priced 6-to-1. I said, that's irrelevant in fracking because, you know, it got to 20-to-1 and people are like, oh, you know, gas has to go higher to match that, the historical average. And this is over 12, 13 years ago. I wrote it, said, no, that is absolutely irrelevant. The price of oil and gas are no longer tied to that conventional BOE. And I think the whole concept of BOEs is ridiculous because it's like kind of like gold equivalent. It's absolutely ridiculous because recovery rates are different and the price the smelters pay for you are different. That's a side point. But what I'm trying to get at is the number of rigs used just 5 years ago, a rig that is designed today, like a fifth generation rig, will do the trips, for example, that, you know, when you drill, then you pull up the drill bit to change the bit. The bits are getting 400, 500, 600% better utilization rates because of the compositions increasing. It's getting more specialized to the specific type of shale. Then they realize with more examples, oh, we're going through this formation, let's use this type of bit. And now is when we're through it, let's specialize it to the different bit. The type of fluids they're using, it's getting down to a science. So that we all agree that rather than taking down your rig, they're walking them and they're doing all these factors. Just, you know, 6 years ago, it'd take 45 to 60 days to complete a serious major frack and complete it, drill frack and complete tie-in. Now you're looking at less than 20 days and you're doing multiple more fracks and in the intensity, the sand and all those factors. So now I believe the technology is getting to a point that is it's significantly increasing. You and I agree there. Where I think we disagree is I think we still in North America have 10 years, a decade of major running room in stabilizing and even in the near term, in certain areas, increasing production. You look at factors like the flaring the gas in the Bakken and certain areas in the Permian. If the government just gave credits to the companies, like, you know, a carbon credit or some sort of financial benefit not to flare that gas, you would look at 2 BCFs of gas that could be imported. And now the U.S. guys could actually be competitive to the Russian gas sector in Europe on the LNG side. So there's a whole geopolitical angle that the Americans can really rattle the Russians there too. Now, that's just North America because we have existing infrastructure, the technology, the industry's built there. But what about Europe? Now, you look at the infrastructure in Europe. The Russians haven't even started fracking. The Chinese have started in the Sichuan Basin, but they're still a couple of decades behind getting to where the North Americans are. Europe is more of a political basket case. So even though areas in Paris have significant, in France, have significant potential for fracking or shale, as does Spain, the UK, the Boland Shales with Quadrilla, which I financed and was the largest shareholder before Lord Brown, who used to run BP and Centric Energy and Riverstone bought us out. Incredible potential. South America, same thing with Argentina and the Vaca Muerta shale, but the infrastructure lacks. So in the near term, it's going to be all North America for the next 10 years. Mexico has a significant potential. And the key thing is to remember, shale is the source rock for the major conventional deposits. What about the Saudis? They're just starting to explore the potential there, and they have incredible infrastructure. And the other OPEC nations are doing the same. So I think in North America, you got 8 to 10 years of legroom. Don't bet against the innovation and technology of the sector. And that's my beliefs. And then I'm kind of risk off in the developments. You know, 10 years ago, I did Quadrilla and other things, but you kind of realize we got out and did well there, but it's a much harder play than in North America.
Okay, Marin. So if your outlook is that for at least the next 8 to 10 years, shale will continue to be a viable source of oil, and we're certainly going to need it. And I think that who's to say how low prices could go, but at least before this Iran kerfuffle came up, and I do think it will eventually blow over, we're probably going to get back down to some prices in the 40s. Is that kind of where you get excited and start buying, or do you really get excited and start buying in the 30s, or is your process disciplined in a way where you never get excited and you're just methodical about doing a certain thing at a certain time?
Unfortunately, my family and friends put me in the latter group that I never get excited because I just stick to the numbers. I think once it touches that 40s, you look at the metrics on the financial balance sheet of these companies and, you know, just because the WTI price or the Brent price may be 44, 45, that doesn't necessarily mean what your company you're looking at produces. So you got to work backwards from their financial statements. What are they getting at the wellhead before? What are their costs in the pipeline? So you got to look at every company's balance sheet. And I think that's a big mistake is the generalization going, oh, it's $50 oil. This is great. But then you look at the differentials and the cost to ship by rail or the pipeline tariffs. You look at it and go, wow, this company's only getting, you know, $28 a barrel. So that, you know, you have to look at the balance sheet. But definitely I see, you know, I'm kind of, my friend Raul is a ultra bear on oil. He thinks it's going down to maybe even break 20 or in the low 20s. I don't know if we get that low because the reality is very few, like that's the lowest cost quartile. When I went to Kuwait in the Middle East, a fantastic well in Kuwait, the top tier well in Kuwait works at, you know, $20 oil. But I don't see any unconventional in North America breaking even at $20 oil. So would I get excited at that price? Oh, most definitely. Do I see that? I just don't. I think we see maybe the 30s, low 30s, mid 30s, high 30s, low 40s. That's kind of where I'm getting, where I see the sector going. I wish I had a number for you, Eric. I just don't. It's more of a range that I see.
And tell us your strategy as you get into these ranges that are attractive to you. Is it entirely looking at small producers where you can get in on financings and, you know, early equity terms? Or are you looking at more established firms? Is it a combination? Tell us how you approach the field.
Yeah, great question. So in this cycle where we are right now in the shale, you do not need to take that, you know, a private placement in a startup that has high risk and execution risk, because the intermediates, the guys producing anywhere from 50,000 barrels a day to 200,000 barrels a day, are priced like a junior. And they also, because of the what's happened in the sector with the sell-off, for example, the Canadian Pension Plan is the largest fund in Canada, and it has essentially zero exposure to the Canadian oil patch. So these oil companies are very, they're like cockroaches. They survive. They know how to survive multiple cycles. But in this sector, a family office or a smart accredited investor gets his broker, or he does the extra work himself, or what I'm doing. I go to these bigger companies with cash flow, with dividends, and they will also, as they expand their infrastructure, or build a pipeline, they will need to do financing or debt or a combination thereof. And that's my process. And once I, you know, in Canada, I've narrowed it down to two stocks I really want in my portfolio. Now to be patient, let's wait for our first tranche. You buy your first 25%. Let's see how it happens. Let's see where the market develops. And sometimes it takes off. And, you know, like, for example, one of our gold stocks, we bought only our first tranche. We're up 35%. And that's it. Now I'm going to wait to buy my second tranche. And we don't have our fill. So I have my quarter position in that one stock that I've wanted. But you got to stay disciplined. You can't chase these stocks. These are very volatile sectors, Eric. And patience. You gotta play the long game. Don't expect to become a Warren Buffett within a year. I've been doing this for almost 20 years, and my strategy has worked. At times, is boring because people. The biggest mistake a subscriber makes is they subscribe today and they say, "Okay, I've got 200 grand, and I want to invest it all on Tuesday." Like, that is the process of failure. The process of winning is saying, "Okay, how much of my portfolio do I want towards energy? And then within the energy, how much do I want towards oil? How much do I want towards uranium? How much you break it down. How much of my portfolio do I want in precious metals?" So for me, I broke it down in our newsletter saying 25% of my portfolio, of my net worth, is in the precious metals sector. And that's across physical gold, producers, you know, explorers type of thing. And in the oil patch right now, I'm very underweight. I have almost no exposure to the energy sector. I have one position that I'm waiting out on, and I'm looking to add to it. Well, I'm going to publish my favorite stocks on that. Subscribers get 2 days to buy before I do. And the beauty is these are big liquid companies that are paying dividends. They're going to survive at $35 oil. That's the stress test. And that's where I kind of see the market pulling back. I don't see $75 oil anytime soon. I see $40 oil before $75. That's kind of my process, Eric.
Well, Marin, that's one place you and I definitely agree, is that assuming that the geopolitical situation blows over, which I think it most likely will, that we head back toward lower oil prices. When we do, let's talk a little bit more about your strategy, because you tend to invest in some smaller companies. And quite frankly, there has been some fraud and some outright misdirection that has occurred in the shale patch. How do you know that you're not getting suckered in terms of getting into a deal with maybe a company that really doesn't have all the resources it claims to?
That's a fantastic question, and a big issue I see in the markets. It's not just in the oil patch. You see fraud in all of these juniors. And you know, I know I'm known as a junior guy, but over 50% of our portfolio is actually dividend paying big stocks. But the market loves that 10-bagger story, right? So that's what I've been famous for in our sector. Regardless of that, you have to go and get to know the management team. You got to go to the site visits. And the reality is I get it. A teacher, a doctor, a construction guy, a realtor, a businessman, he's busy with his family and his workday life. He can't go and do that. And sadly, they are at a disadvantage. Believe it or not, most fund managers, I'll tell you a great story. In 2014, I took about 65 guys in the industry who are well-known guys in the mining sector, and we got on a bus. It was an invite-only thing, and we took them out to my copper mine that I was one of the founders of. It's the third largest producer in the country. And as we go up, we had a microphone. And I said, "Look, I want every guy to come up in front of this audience of 65 on the bus. That's because a three-hour bus ride from Vancouver to Princeton. And let's talk about it." And the first thing I said, "Okay, guys, this is a story of Copper Mountain. We started in 06, blah, blah, blah." And I asked, "How many of you guys have actually been to a producing mine?" And it shocked me. Less than 10 of the 65 guys, and these are some of the biggest names in the business and fund managers in the business and brokers, less than 10 put up their hand of 65 that have been to a producing asset. So it really signified that difference of going to the site. You know, we got a team of geologists and engineers here. You go out and you got to use independent research and know the management team, go to their office, get to know these guys' lifestyles. And it's not that hard to figure out what the hell is going on in the game if you just put that extra factor. So, you know, the most famous scam in the industry was Briex. Well, interestingly enough, my partner was on site and he said, "Wait a second, Briex isn't producing and they're the same market cap as Freeport." So you got to use a little bit of street sense. So hence, that's when Doug Casey sold Briex. He got in at 25 cents. He sold it at over $200. Because it was just, "Wait a second, this makes no sense. How can you be priced at the same price as the world's largest copper producer?" So it comes down to doing your true due diligence. You got to be street smart and you got to be financial savvy. You got to have the geos and the engineers that know what they're doing. And a big scam that nobody talks about in the industry, Eric, is so many analysts in the fund managers in the business focus on the technical reports written by these companies. And I say, guys, this is a 400-page document that everybody thinks should be a pure document, a true technical document. But I do it differently. I have a database of every single one of these companies. I have a database of all the engineering firms that do this. And the engineering firms, you have to remember, are paid by the company. So they work with the company to publish a result. And generally speaking, whoever pays your check is your boss. So these engineers, even though they're trying to be independent, they're paid by these companies. So, and they have to sign off on people. And I believe in Pareto's law. It's a pure mathematics thing that I apply to all of my financial investments. A winner is a winner and a loser is a loser. And so many times, these engineers at these different firms, they bounce around from one engineering firm to another, but they can't change their name. So I track, before I go down to a 43-101 or a pre-feasibility study or a bankable feasibility study, I break down all the names. I search back to their last 10 projects they've worked on. And I see, wait a second, this geologist said this. Oh, the deposit had 40% less gold than they put into production. And then you see that this is a pattern in this individual's behavior and his technical ability, or an engineer who did the metallurgy and said, oh yeah, it's a 90% recovery. When they put the project into production, you realize that it had 70%. Well, that's a big difference. And that's a difference between being economic and uneconomic. And generally speaking, you have to follow not just the money, but the people. That's another aspect that we do. And before I even start into the technical, I look at who wrote this technical report, who signed off on this technical report, and how good were their past work? Because there's no way a guy who is a loser, 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 completely wrong in all his projects before, is all of a sudden going to become a great geologist or a metallurgist or an engineer. It just, there's patterns to success and there's patterns to failure, Eric.
Let me understand then how we came to what I think is really your first oil-focused deal that you've described in your newsletter. Because I've been watching the newsletter. I know from talking to you off the air that you've been thinking that it's time to start focusing on these oil deals. I was expecting to see some kind of shale producer, some small company. You're very good at you know, getting in on the ground floor with small companies, somebody producing oil. And of course, the deal that has been presented to your subscribers, which we can talk about now because it's closed already, is Universal mCloud. And when I first heard about this, I thought, okay, must be cloudy skies in Canada someplace where there's an oil producer if it's called mCloud. No, this is like cloud computing. This is Internet of Things company that Marin Katus is involved in. And I'm thinking, wait a minute, Marin's the commodities guy. This is like a high-tech thing. I don't get it. So I do now get it, but please explain for our listeners where the connection is between oil and Universal mCloud and what they're doing with their sensors and so forth.
For sure. Great, great thing, because I got a lot of feedback on that one. So I've known the management team for over a year, and when they came and pitched, I said, okay, let's see what they do. And essentially where I thought was incredible potential was what they were doing in the oil patch. And like I said, nothing creates innovation more than a downward price in the price of oil, specifically in Canada, and that creates innovation. So at the oil head, they now have sensors where every second you could analyze 500 different data points between your sulfur level, your water level, your pressure, your different aspects, you know, your API, so many of these independent things that 3-4 years ago they didn't have. And the technology now has gone to the point where it's readily available. Now the question is, what does the company do with all this data? So Universal mCloud has one of their subsidiaries is called AutoPro, and they really are a massively growing, innovative company that has over $30 million in revenue just off of what I call the Fitbit for the wellhead. And it tells you exactly what's going on every second with hundreds of data points. Therefore, if the price of oil or your well pressure head, your sand level, it will be able to optimize each of these well heads. And that's just one aspect. Then you look at all of these existing, take the oil sands or, you know, a battery for the oil where all the oil goes to be held before it goes into the pipelines or just your gasification plants. All of these factors, it comes down to, you know, you got to send a crew to innovate. And how do you get enough guys where, you know, you're in the middle of nowhere, you got to send a welding crew, you're looking at a couple thousand bucks an hour to replace a valve or whatever price goes down. And they've created this ability where they've already pre-scanned. Think of blueprints for a house. They make it 3D and each point has a sensor that is telling and it's predictive on how much of the valve is still existing or the pressures. You should take this out. Or more importantly, when it does go out, you know, now you don't need a senior guy because now you put on a headset and it walks you through in 3D what to do. And it's proven to improve the speed by over 30%, which reduces the costs of maintenance. And that's a huge thing, is about utilization rates and downtime. So this company is cash flowing. They make money. The way I structured it was they went to do another deal and they were going to raise $10 million. The management team are going to take $5 million, and a bunch of bankers were wanting them to go on tour. And I just told Russ, who's the president of the company, going, look, I will do half of it personally, but I need these terms. And it was a convertible debenture. And the convertible debenture feature pays me and all my subscribers 10% cash quarterly for 3 years. But if we convert the stock, we get a unit at 50 cents and a full 5-year warrant at 75. And you look at what's going on, they haven't even started in the US, which they will. And then there are other aspects, is like the HVAC business. They did a deal with Bank of America, Tim Hortons, Starbucks. And they're just about cash flowing and just smart business. I expect much larger funds in Canada, REITs coming in, and it's just smart business. So I've structured it where we get paid 10% for 3 years. And if the stock takes off, fantastic. We convert and we're going to make a lot of money. And if the stock just stays as it is in revenues, they're able to pay the debt, and it's a nice pass is the way I see it. I actually believe this management team, who I've gone and spent time, and you go to their office, you go to their assets, you realize that they own 43% of the company themselves. Post the financing we did, they got skin in the game. They've done it before. You know, I'm willing to back these type of right people. So that's where that was.
Now, when I sent my subscription form in, they promptly sent it back and said you only get 80% of what you're asking for. And it's good to see that there's plenty of demand for this. But does all that demand potentially put pressure on the terms that investors are getting in terms of where these conversion prices will actually occur? What is actually guaranteed in this debenture? Is there a specific conversion price
Correct.
And time?
Yep.
Or is it...
Yep. So for 3 years... Every single so this debenture is going to be publicly listed and traded. So it's like a stock. I believe it's going to trade. We did like a 30-page report for all the subscribers, and we showed the true value of that debenture. We think it's going to trade at a big premium. It's going to be listed at $100. We think it's going to trade out of the gates north of 110. So you can sit there and say, well, I've already made 10%. Do I want to wait a year? Do I want to sell it to someone who wants interest or income or a dividend? And then for 3 years, it's only a 3-year term. For 3 years, every debenture holder has the right to convert into a unit at 50 cents. So, you know, if you look at, if you put 10 grand into the debenture, if you can collect $1,000 a year, or you get the right to come, if you put $10,000 in, you can convert to 20,000 units at 50 cents. And with that, you get 20,000 warrants at 75 cents. Stock goes to 80 cents or a buck. You got a nice win there on a debenture. That's how we've structured it.
Now, is this representative of what we should expect? I mean, this is a kind of out of character for Aaron Katusa to be doing sensors and Internet of Things and high-tech stuff, which is really cool. I mean, it's bringing automation and sophistication of technology to the oil patch. It's great, but it's out of the usual norm of producing resource companies that you usually invest in. What should we as subscribers expect? Is this the new direction that you're headed? Is technologies where it's at, or is this kind of a one-off?
Remember, I personally backed the financing, so it's about where I'm putting my own money, and I'm looking at aspects, and it's just about valuation. This company trades at less than a 0.4 NAV compared to its peers. It's just a cheap deal. And look, we have this thing called alligator investing that I kind of talk about all the time. A lot of people don't know that an alligator can go over a year without eating. It controls its metabolism. I just find that species just incredible, just fascinated by them. And when you take that predator approach, going, you know what? I don't need to buy a stock every month. I don't need to trade in and out. If I can just wait and be patient, it's kind of like Warren Buffett's philosophy of wait for the fat pitch, right? Remember, there's no, you don't have to swing. You know, when I became one of the largest shareholders of Altera Power, this was perhaps before I was on your shows, but people are like, what the hell is Marin Katusa doing investing in green energy? I thought he hated green energy. Well, in 2009, I publicly said this stuff is so expensive. It's priced to perfection. And interestingly enough, the chairman and the largest shareholder of Altera at the time was on a panel with me where I said his company will go down between 50 to 75%. I don't know when. It could be 6 months. It could be 12 months, 18. I go, I don't know. But right now, if you analyze the company, it's priced to perfection. At that time, it was priced at $25 a share. About that was September of 2009. It's on YouTube. And, you know, Ross wasn't too impressed with me at the time. By 2014, I phoned him up. So you're talking almost 5 years later. And I said, Ross, your stock's $3 now. I would like to become the second largest shareholder. He owned 30%. I ended up buying just under 10%. And the market was shocked, going, what the hell is Marin doing? How could he like green energy? We're mining people. And I said, it's got nothing to do with what your belief or my belief is. It's about making money. And Altera was so cheap at 350 that I just, for 2.5 years, Eric, I wrote about it and pounded the table on it. And people are like, ah, green energy doesn't work. I said, well, in 2009, it didn't make sense, but the innovation in solar panels, the cost reduced by 90%. You look at the credits that the company got. This is now, the company's actually built these assets, they're cash flowing and paying a dividend, and it's 80% cheaper than it was just 5 years ago. What about this does the market not get? But because there was so much fatigue, people just sold it and didn't care. You know, and then in late 2017, we got an $8.25 bid by Innergex, and it was a great score for our investors. So I will go wherever I see things that are cheap with significant value upside. And I'm kind of off risk right now because the resource sector has gotten so cheap. I don't need to put on body armor like I used to do in 2010 and 11 and 12 and 2005 to go to parts of the world that may not want you and you need to have private security. That's bull market stuff. We're in the bear market. Now I can just drive up to a site that pays me 8% dividend. I can see the stock tripling in a decent market. Why do I need to go somewhere where the person looks at me as a pirate or a predator? I don't need that. So that's where I'm in the market. So I don't know when I'll be able to buy these oil stocks that I'm all excited about. It could be in 3 weeks. It could be in 3 months. But I really don't care because I've done my analysis. I'm just going to wait for the price to come to me like an alligator and then pounce. Will I continue in the Internet of Things? I don't think so. But if the opportunity is so incredibly valued and it's a right structure and I'm going to get paid to hold my stock, I'll definitely look at it. But right now, I think I've nailed the best one in the sector, the cheapest one. I don't need more of it in my portfolio. Hopefully that answers your question.
Okay. Well, it sounds like what we should expect then to watch for in your newsletter in coming months is the plays on the actual resource producing companies. And it sounds like it's just not time yet to buy them. And I'll look forward to seeing that when it comes. I do want to stress for any newer listeners that Marin's newsletter is really not for beginners or for small investors. It's an expensive letter. It's one of the best ones around, but it's not cheap. It's, what is it, $3,500 normally? And Patrick has beaten your guys down again. So the offer for Macro Voices listeners is $19.99, $2,000 basically. I should stress, you know, it's a great newsletter. I'm a subscriber myself. This is not for somebody whose total portfolio is $10,000. You've got to have some significant assets in the resources space. What do you have a guideline, Marin, of how much money somebody should have in the natural resource sector?
You have that angle where, you know, obviously you don't want to spend 20% of your fund on research. That just doesn't make sense. But I created this, you know, it's kind of an interesting story. I didn't go to school to become what people call a newsletter writer. I don't even see myself as a newsletter writer. In fact, I'm probably the largest financier, bigger than most firms in the sector because of the size of my following. And we take no fees off of this. So one thing I want to emphasize, we've raised hundreds of millions of dollars for these companies we believe in, and not a penny has come to me. Zero. Net, zilch. Because I believe that the market has changed. Why do I need some analysts where I've got 10 of them and they're all better than any of the firms out there? we have our skin in the game. We are the largest investors in any deal we do. And it's about learning and the education, my framework, my process. And when I first met Doug and all, you know, the Casey and all these guys back 18 years ago, Doug was fascinated with my process. He's like, wait a second, you went to the site on your own? I go, yeah, why not? You know, I was a young guy. I was a hustler. I did quite well in the markets. I started structuring these deals. And then I started writing for Doug and doing, then I took over managing all his money. And I kind of find it funny that he's the chair of a competitor of mine, and he's one of the largest newsletters in the business, but yet I manage all of his money. It's almost ironic. And so many of these other newsletter writers are not allowed to buy stock that they talk about. Now, why would you ever want to take advice from someone that has no skin in the game? Number two, I do this. So people go, why do you bother writing a newsletter? What the hell is the point? Like, aren't newsletter writers cheesy? Yeah, you're right. Most of them are total knobs. They're paid for pundits. Stay the fuck away from all those morons. Okay. That's the number one rule. Now, guys who are, there are certain good guys that, you know, do the style, but they don't write flashy. They're not guaranteeing. Like, if you listen to the way of saying, I'm like, look, be conservative. Use $35 oil in your numbers. I don't use $100 oil. If anyone's talking about $100 oil, stay the hell away from those guys. Or guys talking about $3,000 oil in their analysis, stay away from those guys. It's about deal flow. So you look at mCloud. How did I get those terms that no one else in the market could get? He knows that, A, number one, that meeting, he doesn't have to go across Canada and spend 2 weeks trying to raise the money from all these brokers and guys that want 8% finder fees and all this bullshit like that. I said, look, if you do five, I'll do five. Here are the terms that work for me. Let's roll. And he knew that I would get it done. Secondly, I said, and I'll bring my subscribers in and we take zero fees. So I do this for deal flow because companies need access to the markets. And because now I've built up the largest resource newsletter, I've got thousands of people, I call them my alligator club, that are all looking to be predators like me to gobble up stock at the best price in the best companies that have the biggest upside. That is why I do it, because I am much stronger with my alligator pack than if I was just a fund manager noodling away on my own. That's why I do what I do, Eric.
Well, Maren, I could go on for hours and hours talking with you about this stuff, but we are going to have to leave it here in the interest of time. Listeners, again, the Universal mCloud deal that we've been discussing, which is just fascinating to me, Internet of Things, sensors on in oil fields communicating wirelessly over the Internet. It's cool stuff. That deal is already closed, so it's too late for that one. But information about Maren's newsletters for future opportunities is at katusaresearch.com/macrovoices. That's also linked in your research roundup email. Again, the URL is www.katusaresearch.com/macrovoices. Don't forget the /macrovoices, because that's the part that gets you the $1,500 discount. And that is a 30-day money-back trial, so by all means, feel free to try it. If you don't like it, by all means, you can cancel with no penalty whatsoever. We are going to leave it there. Maren, thanks so much for a fantastic interview. Patrick Ceresna and I will be back as Macro Voices continues right here at macrovoices.com.
Macro Voices is a listener-driven program. Please email requests for specific future interview guests to requests@macrovoices.com. You can email questions for the program to mailbag@macrovoices.com, and we'll answer them on the air from time to time in our mailbag segment. We also welcome your suggestions for how we can improve the program. Now, back to your hosts, Eric Townsend and Patrick Ceresna.
Eric, it was a great interview with Maren Katusa. Great to have him back on the show. It's always interesting to get an update on how his views on everything like uranium and gold, which is something that interests me a lot, where it's updated. But I've always actually felt that these energy companies are just getting hammered, and at some point there's going to be a screaming buy. It's interesting he doesn't think it's time just yet, but it's certainly something that's been on my mind. What did you take away from the interview?
You know, the thing that really strikes me, I think Marin is very good at what he does. He thinks of himself as a, you know, an expert on precious metals and natural resources and mining and so forth. And he's very good at all those things. Frankly, I think that really a lot of his success comes from his ability to structure deals. You know, the warrants that he described on this Universal mCloud thing, you know, it's just a way of negotiating. You sort of make the deal that makes sense and you throw in that, give us a warrant too, or a half warrant that's above the market, so it's not costing you anything. And of course, later on, it's delivering the investor optionality to potentially buy an option or to have an option that will be in the money when you exercise it. So I'm really impressed with the way that Marin structures his deals beyond just the fundamental market analysis of what deals to make. And of course, that's really strong as well. But in any case, Patrick, I want to move on to our post-game chart book. Listeners, you'll find the download link in your research roundup email. It says post-game chart book. Or if you're not registered yet and don't have a research roundup email, just go to our homepage at macrovoices.com and click the red button that says looking for the downloads, which is right at the top of the page. Patrick, here's what's on my mind. I think that the market should go down as I look at your chart number two, where you've got, you know, what's going to happen next. I think that what ought to happen if I was in charge of the world is we would recognize that there's serious recession risk, that there's ridiculously high equity valuations, and that this entire house of cards that we call a financial market has been built out of central bank largesse. I seem to be in the minority in that view. So the downsloping red arrow that you're showing here, even though I think that's what should happen, I'm rapidly coming around to recognizing the possibility that maybe that's not what's going to happen. And I do think that from a technical perspective, if we break above 3,000 on the S&P, we're probably going much higher. So what I want to talk about for my own trading is, you know, I don't want to be long this market. I don't want to wake up that October of 1987 morning when you're down 25% overnight, and the market's opening, you know, 20% below where it closed the day before. I don't want to be any part of that, but I do want to participate in the upside, even if it's a crazy melt-up. And the way to do that is usually through call options, but you've got so many choices to make around which contract you select and how far out of the money are you going to go and so forth. So how should I be thinking about this problem, and how should I be using options to structure trades?
It's a great question you're asking, and I think this is such a fascinating moment in the markets for this, because to me, somebody is going to be spectacularly wrong, right? Like if you're loaded up on the belief that the market is going to keep ripping higher and we get caught in a major turn and it turns into a bear market, the losses could add up pretty quickly. But equally on the opposite side, if you're completely on the sidelines and in cash, especially if you're an asset manager, there's a serious risk, career risk, in terms of missing out on big gains to the upside, and you're sitting on the sidelines not participating, or even in the worst case, short. And so this is a fascinating time to use options. The key here is that over the long term, just rolling call options is not a good strategy. The theta burn that occurs on rolling premium continuously on an ongoing basis dilutes your long-term return. So if anytime you take a model and you, let's say, said, how would we have done, let's say, over the last 5 years, just rolling call options, it's always going to underperform just owning the asset. That's just fact. But this is an interesting moment in the market where you don't want that stock market downside risk, and yet you want that optionality of that if the market rips higher, you're going to make money. And this is where I want to debate, well, what if you used call options? How would they perform? And which call option would you choose? Do you choose an in the money, at the money, out of the money? How do they perform in comparison? And let's see if we can draw some conclusions. Now, last week when we were talking about this, you suggested rolling like a 30-cent delta call option forward. So I made sure I included a 30-cent delta option in our chain to kind of look at it. But we're going to do a little case study. And what our listeners can see on page 3 of the chart book that's available in that research roundup email, and or just get the chart book off the website. We're looking to gain upside exposure. We're comparing what if investor A was just going to buy the shares, and how would it compare if we started with August 16th options, which are 50 days until their expiration, right? Today's June 27th, and we're going out to August 16th, so 50 days. And we're looking at three particular call options. And I chose the strike prices of 285. Remember, at the time when we're doing this, the SPY was trading at $291.34. And the implied volatility close on it was just over 14%. So we're looking at a $285 strike, which is just over $6 in the money. And at the money, $291 strike call option. And an out of the money, $300 strike call option. So why these particular three strikes? Well, the 285 strike has a close to a 70 cent delta. So we wanted to buy some intrinsic value deeper in the money, an option that will behave more like the underlying because the delta is higher. Just an at the money, just so we have a comparison, something close to a 50 cent delta. And then I wanted to go with the out of the money, which we're getting that 30 cent delta, which is about the $300 strike call. So let's take a look at what's happening here. Now, Eric, before we get to the actual outcomes, I wanted to jump to page 4 to actually just show the vol skew that actually happens in options on the S&P 500. Now, in some places like the gold markets and treasury bond markets, you have really nice U-shaped skews. What is normal in equity markets, particularly in indexes like the S&P, is you have this massive fat left tail and a downward sloping skew that the farther you're going out of the money on the calls, the lower the implied volatilities are. That means you're paying a rich tail risk vol premium, and it actually gets cheaper and cheaper to buy on a relative basis to buy out of the money call options to participate on the upside. A lot of people speculate that that has a lot to do with the amount of premium harvesting that is occurring on out of the money strikes that creates the skew, as well as all the people that try to implement callers and other things that create this.
Okay, Patrick, let's go through the scenarios of different approaches using either at the money or well out of the money or maybe partly out of the money options and see how they compare.
Right. So on slides 5, 6, 7, and 8 and 9 are all the different scenarios that happen. So what we wanted to do is take four investors A, B, C, and D, and each one are trading a different vehicle. So investor A just buys the physical shares of the SPDR ETF on the S&P 500. Investor B is using a high delta option. Investor C is using the at the money, and investor D is using the out of the money option. And we're going to pay a little attention to investor D because investor D is buying the lower vol out of the money. And it's also a 30 cent delta, something that you referenced last week in the show. So we can kind of track the investor D to see what results they're getting by using that kind of 30 cent delta option as a way of gaining exposure to the markets. And so we wanted to do a case study of each investor just A, buying either the shares, 100 shares, or just buying one call option of each. Now, of course, many of our listeners, which are very smart, will know that you can certainly buy more of the cheaper option and leverage up and all these different variables. But just for comparison's sake, we're just going to assume one call option just so we can be comparing apples to apples on this. And so on page 6, what I just show is the starting delta dollar exposure, which is essentially what is the aggregate amount that each option is behaving as. Right. And so in investor A, who physically owns 100 shares of the S&P 500, their 100 shares are at a delta one, which is what stocks behave as, is literally behaving as the $29,000 that was outlaid to buy the shares. But what's interesting is investor B, by buying some intrinsic value in a higher delta, is actually, even though they're only outlaying $1,137 to buy the call, they're actually getting 70 cents on the dollar exposure to the upside of the market. The delta dollars is $19,956, almost $20,000 of delta dollars, even though they're only outlaying a fraction of the risk capital that investor A is doing. And when we go to investor C, again, it's just multiplying the delta dollars through to being 16,000. And investor D, which is our 30 cent delta options trader who bought the $300 strike call option, outlaid $245 or $2.45 a call, and at a near 30 cent delta, that starting delta for the position is $8,594. So that means that one call option that was purchased for $245 is behaving as though it was like $8,600 of S&P.
Patrick, let's look at this then in terms of the performance. What happens if the market's going up quickly as we think it could? What happens if the market stays flat? What happens if the market goes down?
Well, this is where we have to observe. Like, for everything that we said, this is where the really interesting part is. How much did the call option participate in each of the scenarios with the upside of the market? But what if the market crashes? How much did each one lose? And I think that's where the looking at the asymmetry in the trading really comes to light. And so in scenario one on page seven, we're looking at, well, Brent Johnson and Kevin Muir and all these guys are right. The S&P 500 melts up and we find ourselves over the next 30 days. So remember, the options we bought were 50 days. They were the August 16th expiry. So over the next 30 days, let's say to the end of July, the S&P 500 breaks to a new high after the G20 and just rips. And we're now at 3,100 on the S&P 500 in 30 days. So how did each investor perform? And what I find really interesting first is between investor A and B. So investor B bought in the money call option, which had that 70 cent starting delta. Investor A, who owned the shares. And what's interesting is that their performance was actually pretty close. I mean, you had the investor A, who owned the physical shares, outlaid close to $30,000 to buy them, finds themselves up just over $1,800 in profit. While investor B, who would just outlay just over $1,000 to control the high delta position, finds themselves up $14 or $1,400 on that call option, more than doubling their return on capital risk outlay on there. But the key here is that option that investor B controlled really did actually behave a lot like the stock ownership. Now, I want to move right to investor D because that's our 30 cent delta call, the one who bought the out of the money 300 call. And this is where the speculator tends to often get big payoff for leveraging up, because what you can see is that while our investor was up $8.42 or $842, it's not as much as investor B with the deep in the money. But our investor only outlaid $245 to buy that call option, which is now worth over $1,000, like a threefold plus increase in its value. And so the key here is that the investor D was able to own an option with a very small capital outlay and capture pretty much almost half of the upside potential of the market with almost little to no risk outlay.
Well, Patrick, this slide is easy for everybody to like because everybody's making money. What happens if the market's flat or even goes down?
Right. So this is scenario two. And this is where scenario two is just over the next 30 days, the market ends up going up a little bit, down a little, and remains unchanged over that time frame. And so we have a scenario where if the S&P 500 is exactly where it started 30 days earlier, the options investors B, C, and D all equally suffered time decay, right? Which is the theta burn that comes from having paid premium to have exposure to the market and the market not doing anything while you own those calls. And so investor A, who owned the shares, obviously didn't lose anything, obviously lost the opportunity to make money, but certainly not down from a profit loss perspective. But in each of those scenarios, what we did was experience considerable amount of time decay. But what is interesting on a percentage basis, investor D, which paid $2.45, that option at this moment with 2 weeks left till expiry is worth about 74 cents and has lost more than half of the premium that they outlaid in that option. And that's the cost of carry. At this moment, going back to that scenario you were saying where, well, let's roll every 30 days on this option. Like, we're going to go buy a 30 cent delta call and every 30 days we roll forward. Well, in this situation, that $1.70 loss was was your carry, your cost of having held that option rather than owning the market. And you would just roll it forward and go another 30 days out further from, let's say, August to September, and then you would continue to wait to see whether the market breaks out. But where the asymmetry is the most evident is scenario number 3, which is on page 9. And this is exactly, Eric, why you were talking about wanting to use call options instead of owning the shares. Because ultimately, the scenario that that bull scenario that the Brent Johnsons of the world are touting, this idea the market can make big money on the upside is great. But what if? What if the bear market rears its head? And what if this is a topping formation? And what if what happened in October, November, and December of last year suddenly manifests itself here and we have the markets plunging lower? And this is in scenario 3, I just took a market drop equal to what we experienced in October of 2018, just the past October, the first leg of the market drop. And so here I dropped the SPY down to the 260 level, about a 30-point drop. And what you can see is that investor A, the one who physically owns the shares, definitely took the brunt of the hit, right? This is where you're down $31 a share, you're down $3,000+ on your 100 shares of the SPY. But where the asymmetry of using the call option is when you look at investors B, C, and D that use the options, their risk was very defined. And that was to the capital they outlaid for those calls. And while they participated on a very good chunk of the majority of the upside, their risk was quite limited to the downside. And that is actually that asymmetry that a trader is seeking in this current market environment. And this is where the trade-off comes to what I said at the beginning, which is, over the long term, this is not a great way to play options. Over a 5-year period, continuously rolling call options is not necessarily a way to create alpha. But in a unique time in the market like this, where we literally can have an explosive move one way and an explosive move the other way, using the asymmetry in limited risk with unlimited upside potential that you can gain from options makes it a very interesting way to express the trade, especially now the volatility is still relatively low. I mean, the implied volatilities right now are still in the lower end of the teens, right? And so it's not like we're dealing with a VIX up in the 20 to 30 range where these call options start becoming expensive and you have a big vega risk.
Okay, so to pull all of this together, as I think about the scenario that I'm concerned with, which is if a market melt-up starts, you know, I can buy the S&P, this is option A, at $29,134. The problem with that, Patrick, although you're showing a loss here of $31.34 here, that was on a drop to, you know, $2,600. What happens if we get more of an October 1987 event and you're down more than $10,000 overnight on that position? That's the risk I don't want to take. So if I think about this in terms of the way I might approach it is to think, okay, I want to be exposed to the market and I want to do it with call options. As you say, it's not the right strategy to use most of the time. But if you think there's going to be a melt up where there's very rapid pace of price increase until you eventually get to a blow off top and a reversal to the downside, which is what I think could be coming in the next 6 to 12 months if we do get this melt up, then what you might do as a strategy is say, okay, I'll take 1% of my account size. I'll spend that on options each month. And I'm going to use those options to be exposed to the market. And, you know, if I make money, that's wonderful. If I end up losing all of the money I spent on my options, well, it's 1%. It's not the end of the world. It's certainly not 25 to 40% down, as you could see in an outright market crash if you were exposed to the underlying. So the question is, which of these different choices I might choose? Let's suppose, for sake of argument, that what I've got to spend is $1,200. Well, I could buy that 1-285 SPY call. That really is giving me the same kind of upside potential as being long the shares, except I'm going to lose that whole $1,200. I'm not too crazy about that. If I've got that same $1,200 to spend, I could instead spend it on buying not just one, but three of those investor D 300 calls. I could have triple leverage there, so that if it goes above 3,000 on the S&P, I'm making, you know, three times as much as I would have made. It's going to be great. The thing is, that option expires completely worthless unless you get from where we are right now to above 3,000 in just 50 days or 30 days if you're going to roll the option at that point. So I've really got to think, you only want to be that far out of the money if you really think there's a chance of the market moving up that quickly in the course of 1 month that you could be in the money by the end of the month. And that really is where the trade-off is in terms of these different deltas. Is there any formula that we can use? I mean, it seems like, you know, it's hard to guess if you think a market melt-up's going to happen. You know, how many points per month is it going to melt up? It's really hard to estimate.
I don't use a formula per se. I always work backwards, which is, you know, as a technician, I build on the charts my expectations where I think a market can go, right? So like last week's chart book, we were talking about where the measured moves on the upside of the S&P 500 would be if there was a breakout. And so in the end, what I do is I kind of build a scenario of the what ifs. Well, what if we're right and it bullishly does break out and it goes here to the second target level? Which option will give me the best asymmetry and make sure I can build enough intrinsic value if I'm right, but at the same time, how much leverage can I gain? And so you basically work backwards, first building the scenario you think will happen, and then you can stress test two or three different ways to put the options trade on and then see which one best suits the narrative you've built.
Okay, well, I think this pretty much explains it as best as we can in the time that we have available. Now, for our listeners who would have liked the deeper explanation and the full description of all the Greek letters that Patrick's talking about, the theta decay and so forth, keep in mind, Patrick does teach options trading classes that go into the gory detail of all this stuff. You can get a 14-day free access pass to Big Picture Trading just by going to bigpicturetrading.com. The other thing, Patrick, I want to bring up before we close this week is you've got a speaking engagement coming up at Traders Expo Chicago, July 21st through 23rd. What's going on there? What can people expect?
Well, I'm going to be out at the show. Big Picture Trading is a booth going on there, but I had the opportunity to be a part of the Global Macro Edge series there with John Netto, who we're going to be having on the show in the coming future. And what we're going to be doing out there is I'm going to be a part of the bull versus bear smackdown debate as to where stocks and bonds are heading next. And John Netto is going to be moderating that debate between me and Kevin Muir. And as well, I'm going to be doing a presentation on straddles again about how you can use them to catch market tops. So I'll be doing that live out there. And it's going to be an opportunity to meet many of our listeners. So those of you that can make it out to Chicago during that July 21st to 23rd period, put it on your schedule. It's free to attend. It's going to be a great show. We'll be there talking with all of our listeners. So it'd be such a pleasure to meet many of you.
That's fantastic, Patrick. I'm sure that our Chicago listeners, as well as those that are able to travel to Chicago, will enjoy your presentation at that event. Meanwhile, we're going to have to leave it there in the interest of time. Today's episode was made possible by Top Traders Unplugged. Don't forget to go to toptradersunplugged.com/macro to claim your free book and subscribe to their podcast as well. For information on sponsoring Macro Voices yourself, please visit macrovoices.com/sponsor info. And folks, we really appreciate your ratings and reviews on iTunes, so please keep them coming. And likewise, I cannot thank the many of you who have donated enough. We are still in the process of trying to acquire more sponsors, and those donations are keeping us going in the meanwhile. So thank you to everyone who has donated. And listeners, be sure to go to macrovoices.com to sign up for your free account so that you'll receive our free research roundup email each week, which delivers a compendium of links to all of the best content that we could find on the internet, including the downloads for things like the chart book that we just talked you through in the postgame segment, as well as downloads from our feature interview guests. Patrick, tell them what they can expect to find in this week's research roundup.
Well, this week you're going to find the transcript for today's interview with Marin Katusa, as well as the charts and explanation of the options we talked about here in the postgame. There's also an article from Jesse Felder titled, "You Better Be Careful and Keep Your Eyes Open," and a great article from Nouriel Roubini titled, "The Coming Sino-American Bust-Up." So you'll find this and so much more in this week's Research Roundup. That does it for this week's episode. We appreciate all the feedback and support we get from our listeners, and we're always looking for suggestions on how we can make the program even better. For those of our listeners that write or blog about the markets and would like to share that content with our listeners, send us an email at researchroundup@macrovoices.com or tag it with the MVRR hashtag on Twitter, and we'll include it in our weekly distributions. If you have not already, follow our main Twitter account at macrovoices for all the most recent updates and releases. You can follow Eric on Twitter at Eric S. Townsend and myself at Patrick Ceresna. On behalf of Eric Townsend and myself, thank you for listening, and we'll see you all next week.
That concludes this edition of Macro Voices. Be sure to tune in each week to hear feature interviews with the brightest minds in finance and macroeconomics. Macro Voices is made possible by sponsorship from BigPictureTrading.com. The Internet's premier source of online education for traders. Please visit BigPictureTrading.com for more information. Please register your free account at MacroVoices.com. Once registered, you'll receive our free weekly Research Roundup email containing links to supporting documents from our featured guests and the very best free financial content our volunteer research team could find on the Internet each week. You'll also gain access to our free listener discussion forums and research library. And the more registered users we have, the more we'll be able to recruit high-profile feature interview guests for future programs. So please register your free account today at macrovoices.com if you haven't already. You can subscribe to Macro Voices on iTunes to have Macro Voices automatically delivered to your mobile device each week free of charge. You can email questions for the program to mailbag@macrovoices.com, and we'll answer your questions on the air from time to time in our mailbag segment. Macro Voices is presented for informational and entertainment purposes only. The information presented on Macro Voices should not be construed as investment advice. Always consult a licensed investment professional before making investment decisions. The views and opinions expressed on Macro Voices are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect those of the show's hosts or sponsors. Macro Voices, its producers, sponsors, and hosts Eric Townsend and Patrick Ceresna shall not be liable for losses resulting from investment decisions based on information or viewpoints presented on Macro Voices. Macro Voices is made possible by sponsorship from BigPictureTrading.com and by funding from Fourth Turning Capital Management, LLC. For more information, visit MacroVoices.com.